Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 19 of Launch and Learn. This episode, we talk to Doug Vance Bronson, who is the co-founder of Verset, a digital services consulting agency based in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And basically what they do is help businesses launch new customer-centric companies and stay up to date in a digitized and ever-changing world. So a really cool conversation. We talk about building a global business and about what the future of the workforce will look like. We even have a Christopher Nolan reference, so make sure you're listening for that. You're gonna really like this conversation. Enjoy.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Doug, for coming on the show.
Glad to be
Always
here.
Good to have a fellow Canadian on, so thanks for coming on.
Yeah, very glad to be here.
Our usual question when we start is what you had for lunch, but I guess we'll start with breakfast for you, eh?
Yeah, this morning was a stiff black coffee at about 3:30 a.m. after my son woke up. He's 2.5 months old, so he decided to give us a little bit of an early jump start to the morning. So after that, it was off to the day. So coffee was my beginning.
Nice.
Sounds great.
So you're ready then for the conversation?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Cool. So why don't we just get started with some of your background, how you got interested in entrepreneurship and business to begin with?
Yeah. So I think entrepreneurship was kind of just in my blood. Both my grandfather and my dad were entrepreneurs. My grandfather immigrated from the Netherlands into Canada. And I think from that point on, they just really thought about, you know, how to build community and how to build businesses. And they ran a roofing company, building supply company. And so I just was in that environment when I was younger. And I think it always looked like something that I kind of wanted to do. And so after university, actually, my first sort of job was starting a company with one of my professors after a business degree, and kind of got the bug from there. And I've probably just made myself unemployable ever since. I really do enjoy building things and working with teams to make meaningful work. And so that's been sort of my start. And it eventually led me to found Verset about 8 years ago as of last week. And that's really been my primary focal point for the broader part of my career.
Great. And can you tell us a bit more about Verset, and as well as why did you start it?
Yeah, I think Verset was really a response to the broader kind of secular trends that I think a lot of people were observing, 8 or 9 years ago, where the world was adapting so quickly and change was so constant that it was becoming clear that for businesses, when they were looking at sort of their risk profile, the probable riskiest thing they could do would be to not take action. And if you believe in a world that change is accelerating, then not taking action became sort of untenable. And so the kind of opportunities that they were looking at were, you know, how do we leverage technology? How do we apply it to our business? How do we, you know, ensure that we're competitive in the future? And so when we started Verset, we sort of said, okay, well, how and what, you know, what are the types of things that those companies would need in order to really accelerate their growth? And so we set off to help businesses build the most customer-centric companies. And how we do that is we sort of look at our role as a platform. So we have a services layer where we have individuals who are trained and skilled across a few different disciplines, so strategy, UX, UI, technology, etc. And then we have other elements of that platform, so access to sort of our global network of partners, the software that we use, sort of our proprietary methodologies and ways of working. And that's all at the disposal of the clients that we work with. And so when you sort of work with Verset, you get access to that broader platform. And that's really our objective, is to help our clients become more customer-centric, to really help accelerate the things that they're really good at and fill the gap areas where they can improve and grow. And that's been the vision, and that's really what we've built from the start.
Maybe you can speak a bit to how you met your co-founder and what your sort of first projects look like as you're starting up.
Yeah, so my co-founder is a guy named Laurent Silva. He's actually originally from France, and like all origin stories, we met through a few mutual friends and hit it off over a few glasses of wine. And I think we both saw the world the same way, and really saw this growing need for, you know, businesses who kind of said, okay, technology is going to be at the center of my company, and how do we address that? I think we both saw that need and really hit it off. So we started the company out of my condo, and really, I think, immediately decided or made a decision to say that we wanted to work globally and not just confined to sort of our local parameters. And so we designed the company that way. And I think that's been able to allow us to work on a lot of interesting things all over the world. And I think, you know, it's sort of allowed us to attract really good talent and also work on, you know, projects that are driving an immediate impact. So that was really the intention. We got our lucky breaks along the way. We've had the opportunity to work with some really interesting companies through all sorts of different means. We've had an amazing team that's really enabled that. And so it's been a really interesting journey, and I think we're still in sort of the early innings of that, both from an industry perspective, but also from Verset's perspective. From the very beginning, we kind of said, okay, we know that this is needed. So we need to kind of write the playbook on how to solve that problem. And in many cases, write it with our clients, because there's just so much, you know, open field in terms of how companies should be adapting to technology and what are the different ways they can leverage it.
But even having said that, I mean, getting your first clients is always super difficult. Do you have a track record, or what was sort of your strategy to get these first, let's say, hooked?
Yeah, I think, it's interesting. I think in a global economy, and we definitely benefited from this, what people are looking for is specialization. You know, there's a yearning for you know, clarity on how companies can assist them. And so our sort of first wedge was really into high fidelity product and UI design. And so we had a really capable team who could deliver, you know, at scale, kind of really before design systems were a thing, but thinking through the lens of design systems. And so that really was our first entry point. We got a lucky break working with one of our large clients who's still a partner to this day, which is American Express Global Business Travel. We got a lucky break with them, and really was able to translate that into future work and more things. So yeah, I think there's always it's a mix of luck and sort of different parts of that journey. But I think along the way, the one thing we tried to stay consistent was around, and this is probably true of most services businesses, is to be really selective of the kind of things that you're working on, because if it's not helping you sort of gain worthwhile experience or learn something or move forward, then it's likely not something you should be doing. So we tried to be quite selective on the types of things we worked on from the start. And I think that served us well.
And what was your pitch? Did you kind of say you were more of a agency, a consultancy? What were sort of the first offerings you started to offer?
Yeah, it's so funny. I don't think we've ever nailed a name for ourselves. You know, it's I think lots of people have allergic reactions to the consultancy name, and in many ways to agency as well. You know, it just means so many different things, and the quality levels are so variant. And so that's really why we focused on, you know, creating customer-centric companies as our shtick. And I think that really is encompassing of a lot of different services and things that we do. But the important thing for us is that we didn't paint ourselves into a corner by saying, okay, we're a mobile design firm, or we are a React dev shop, or anything that sort of limits the really ability to be effective. And I think we call it internally like hammer nailitis, where you get this disease where, you know, everything looks like a nail when you've got this big hammer. And I think it's one of the issues that plagues a lot of agencies and product design firms, that this kind of stark reality that not every single problem can be solved with a web app. but sometimes that's what it feels like, right? You know, you're brought into to solve a particular issue or address a problem, and if your only tools are, you know, designing web apps, you're probably not going to drive a lot of change. And so we've always tried to broaden that aperture and to say, okay, well, you know, what does this company do really well, and how can we accelerate or tap into that? And in the cases that it's not something that's in our wheelhouse, how do we enable them to connect to the right firm, the right people, hire the right people in order to drive that organizational change? And in the cases where we can help directly, you know, how do we ensure that that actually gets actualized? So, to answer the question, we've really kind of, we've said we're a global firm, you know, trying to create Earth's most customer-centric companies. And beyond that, we try not to limit, you know, what that means, because it really does adapt and change every year.
Being a global firm, could you give some examples of maybe, I don't know, projects that you've been proud of, things that were fun for you? I don't know, just generally speaking.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think there's so many unique parts of the projects. And because we're not working on hundreds of projects at a time, we try to be really selective of the ones we work on. And so the natural result is that we actually really enjoy almost all the things that we do. But I think what we're finding is that there's tremendous opportunity to unlock within organizations that are really underserved by some of the best practices out there. So as an example, the kind of world has shifted where on one hand you have large scale aggregators or companies that are able to at their scale aggregate supply and demand, really invest in technology and reach, and are succeeding in an internet enabled world because of their scale. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have like specializers. So like companies that really do one thing well, and because the world is more connected, they can access a broader customer base, are able to really do that one thing super efficiently and really well. And you see that on like, if you even take an industry like the direct to consumer play would be more on the specialization. You have the aggregators like an Amazon in retail, for example. But this is playing out in every industry. And the companies in the middle are really underserved. And I think oftentimes, just because of how the service industry has crept up, there's firms that really specialize on the specializers, and there's agencies and consulting firms that specialize on the aggregators. But in the middle, there's sort of this messy middle. And so where we've really found a lot of value is to help, you know, private companies that are anticipating change adapt to that. So I'll give you a practical example. We worked with a large appliance retailer in Canada. They have about 9 or 10 retail locations across the country, and they had no real internet presence, but they saw this ongoing threat where they had specialty niche online retailers that were sort of owning the traffic online acquisition funnel and therefore filtering into offline sales. And on the other end, they saw more pressure from Wayfair and Amazon and these larger aggregators. And in the middle, they're this, you know, kind of middle ground saying, okay, well, how do we adapt to change? You know, are we able to move up the stack to an aggregator, or do we need to move down the stack to the specializer, or what does that mean for us? And so for them, you know, we developed, and this is right around pre-COVID times, really built in this model to say, how do we allow your customers to purchase and buy and research from you in the way that they want to, on the time that they want to? And so a big part of that was enabling e-commerce, but it was also around enabling chat-based sales, consultative approaches online, and really a long tail content strategy around ensuring that they found this retailer and they were able to match together. And so what was really quite interesting about that, just as a tiny fact, was about 50% of the sales that were driven through the site, and it's achieved scale relatively quickly, were done through the chat widget. So enabling, because these are complicated things. You know, you buy a dishwasher and it needs to fit the dishwasher hole that you're replacing it on, and you need the right the tubes and the hookups and these kind of things. So the reason I mention that as a product is because it's made a discernible impact on every part of that business. They now look at, you know, how they operate as a self-serve organization to really enable that with their customers. And it's sort of paying dividends across the full network. So that makes their stores stronger. It makes their partners with their suppliers stronger, because it's a MRSP type business. And so the more volume you move, the better rebates you get. So this sort of touches on all aspects of the company. So those types of projects are really exciting. But then on the other hand of the spectrum, we also love, you know, working with sort of forward thinking organizations. And so we wrapped up a design project with a with the Middle East's first digital first bank called Yap. And so in that case, we were designing out really the full interface on how consumers and businesses and families bank, and sort of the unique aspects of each one of those. They launched with all three, which is a pretty bold ambition. And so, you know, it's really fun to get your hands dirty on the research side. We're big believers in, well, all the way through the research stack, ethnographic, et cetera, but also just really getting into local markets and understanding how, you know, buyers buy. And we're launching a large a digital insurance business in the Caribbean. And so really digging into, you know, the purchasing behavior patterns of folks in Guyana and Barbados and how that differs island to island, and you know, what the different dynamics of a of an insurance purchase are in that area. We love digging our heads into that. So that's sort of the, some of the fun stuff that we've been working on lately.
And how do you do some of that research? I mean, do you have a playbook? Do you have certain, I don't know, checklists that you have to go through, like Google yeah. Trends or I don't know?
Yeah, well, I think, so that's actually a great question. We're constantly evolving ourselves on that as well. So we do have a playbook. So we have sort of a list, and I kind of think of it as like a bookshelf, right? Where, you know, you look at your shelf of all these different ways of approaching research, and you pull off the right volumes depending on the needs of the project. So we've built up our own sort of database of tactics and ways of getting at information. But I think one of the things we try to do a lot at First Ed is to say, what tactics and methodologies are successful in other industries than our own? And so sometimes it's very interesting and to say, okay, well, how do, you know, the best companies in the world approach user interface research, let's say. The other way you could look at it is say, well, how do other companies research? And so one of our favorite kind of minds to look at is short sellers. So if you want to know about research, short sellers are the best researchers in the world, because their entire game is about understanding the fundamental dynamics of a business. And so how they go about it is they find sort of non-traditional ways of looking at research. So, you know, the a good example would be like, you know, you can read a financial report for a business and get a pretty good sense of how they view their business, but is that true? What's really happening? And a short seller would say, well, I'm going to go visit every single store and just watch. I'm going to count how many people actually buy things at this store to generate my, you know, store-to-store sales numbers and see if they match up with the company. And so we try to take those sort of guerrilla tactics the same way. You know, in the retailer example, we had people in the stores just going to all the competitor stores and just sitting there. How do they sell? Why do they sell? You know, what are the things that they say? And just observing and really trying to figure out, you know, what makes successful companies tick. And so one of the things we try to do a lot is to say, yes, there are defined playbooks, but what would somebody just really smart thinking about this and looking at the company saying, what do I want to know? Well, probably what you want to know as a retailer is like, why are customers coming to stores and not other stores? What's driving that? And then peeling back that sort of further, you know, why are they ending up there? Well, in the case of the retailer that I mentioned earlier, it was because the acquisition online was such a strong engine with one of their competitors that, you know, any kind of model number based search query would land on this retailer site. They'd have a clear path on the SEO long tail strategy. And it was driving in-store conversion because people said, oh, I really want this certain Bosch dishwasher. You know, I'm going to end up on that path just because they owned that top of the funnel. So I think you can unsurface a lot of or uncover a lot of different meaningful data points if you're open to thinking through research beyond just a typical, you know, ethnographic lens or survey-based lens or, you know, readily accessible data.
I think the short selling approach is probably good until someone finds out about it on Reddit, right?
Yeah. So. I'm not recommending being a short seller right now. Not a good time for them.
You mentioned a few countries, like regions you're working with, which I think is pretty cool. Like you said, you started off with a global mindset from the start. How did you build your team with sort of this global reach in mind? How did you build up your offices and where you pick your team from?
Yeah, so I think like all companies, our thoughts are really evolving on this, you know, as we speak. I think we've really tried to hire on merit and skill level. And we have centralized that through sort of two offices. So we have an office, two offices in Canada. But I think that sort of office centricity is probably evolving away. And I think our views on that have really changed. We have a pretty wide global network of specialists that we tap into for particular needs and skill sets. So around domain expertise, like let's say media buying or maybe it's SEO, you know, our view would be that in general, some of the best specialists in the world are working for themselves and continue to and into the future. And that trend will only accelerate. We think that will happen within consultancies as well. So one of the interesting dynamics of that is, you know, if you are a high level consultant at Bain or McKinsey, and you just sat at home for the last year with a very different schedule and a very different lifestyle, it's quite possible that there's a non-significant, you know, a non-insignificant fraction of those individuals who won't want to go back to the on an airplane every day travel type schedule. And I think this was going to bring open a different type of talent pool that is interested in working in different ways. And I think part of Verset's, you know, I mentioned at the top that we really look at ourselves as a platform. I think a big part of that platform will be enabling folks like that to have an ability to connect with us and other companies like ours to make a meaningful impact without having to be tethered to a large organization. So to that end, I think our global impact will likely shift and change as we adopt to that. But I really like the path that we're on as a sort of industry to say where, you know, the role of the consultancy is more around producing the movie. So, you know, we're getting hired to help build and create value for our clients. And the way we do that is by assembling the right cast, by, you know, creating the right film crew, et cetera, to keep that analogy further. And that I think will increasingly be made up of, you know, in our case, a mixture of Verset talent, but then also a sort of network of really skilled individuals who could be working from anywhere. And I think we've noticed, you know, even pre-COVID, throughout our whole journey, that companies generally don't care if you're working remotely. They want to have a high touch at certain points of the project. So we make an emphasis on, you know, earlier parts when we're building rapport and learning more about each other to be in person through sessions. But a lot of our work is delivered remotely. And I think it hasn't, you know, diminished our output or our quality. In many cases, our clients are working all over the world as well. So it's just not feasible to be in person all the time. So I think a lot of those trends will continue. And I think they've definitely been accelerated by COVID.
Yeah, I think it's a super fascinating trend that we're seeing. I mean, how do you choose then between, okay, who do we want to hire for in-house, like staying with us, versus, hey, let's, you know, pick these people for one specific project?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we're wrestling with that. You know, there's, I think we generally would always want to keep the stable, you know, within Verset, that core team, you know, the best we possibly can. So hiring is an important part of that, and achieving scale and quality is essential. So, you know, there'll always be a core team that sort of leads that. And I think we've worked quite hard on sort of developing our own methodology and our way of thinking about these types of projects. And so part of that is trained, right? You know, really digging into it. A lot of it is experience driven. You know, have you applied that successfully across a number of projects? And so it's valuable to have that skill set in-house. That being said, there are certain skill sets that, you know, are better suited to sort of one-off engagements or kind of drop-in, drop-out type work, and others that are not, you know. So there, I could see a world where, let's say, a design system specialist would be really valuable to certain types of companies, right? Where, you know, their whole impact area is around creating a performant design componentized design system for an organization. That's probably a one-off skill that could be applied widely that wouldn't need to live within Verset. And we have those skill sets internally. But there might be, you know, a reason to have that external at some point. And I think a lot of different skill sets are that way. But the ones that are less easy to kind of drop in and out of would be sort of the sense-making or broader generalist approach to intuiting what needs to be done. So, you know, how and what a business should do, it requires, you know, a different type of experience set. And I don't think we've seen quite that diaspora of talent emerge there, but I think it will. So it's going to be interesting to see how companies adapt to that on both ends of the spectrum, because I think that will likely be the one of the broader shifts in service delivery. I think that would be shift number one, and shift number two would probably be related to how software enables consulting services more broadly. We're still early innings in that area as well.
Yeah, I think you mentioned like learning from other industries, and this analogy of a movie producer is quite compelling, I think, about having like a core team that stays with the studio, and then sometimes you hire out, you know, actors or different role players to fill in different scenes.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like, you know, when you hire like Christopher Nolan to produce a film, right? You're buying Christopher Nolan's ability and experience to assemble a team to build something meaningful. You're not just buying him. You're paying him to create the right group. And he, for sure, and I don't know a lot about his process, but you know, he would have his favorites in different areas that he would assemble. But if he's shooting in Tunisia or if he's shooting in Europe, he's going to bring different pieces in for that role. And I think there's a lot of practical sense there. And in, you know, the thing that I think a lot of people forget is that like modern consulting it was invented in the 30s. Like it's a relatively new thing. You know, the biggest firms in the world have really only been around since the 30s and 40s. So the thought that the only model that works is hire MBAs from the top schools, train them, incentivize them to work hard, drive up the partnership stack for kind of profit accumulation. Even that model is relatively new. Like it's a lot of that is based off of like the Cravath system, which was one of the larger legal firms. And, you know, I think a lot of that stuff has sort of been accepted as like, you assemble the biggest tool of talent and you say, we are good at everything. I don't know if that's going to be the case forever. And there's value in that for sure, to have the top talent. But I think as the world accelerates and skills start to get more and more specialized, it's going to be harder for companies to say with complete transparency that they actually have all the best talent in every single area. It might be more compelling to say we have access to and we have relationships with and we will assemble for, you know, your unique needs. And I think certain companies are already starting to do that. And one of the missing pieces of this puzzle, of course, is that companies are also building great internal talent, right? So, you know, there are great internal teams within a lot of these organizations, or they're trying to build them. And so if part of your mix is we don't play well with others, then I think that's a bit of a problem. So part of that producing the movie was likely leveraging internal capacity and internal, you know, insight as part of that journey. So I think there's, you know, if you're going to bet on a horse, I think that would be the one that to me makes the most long-term success. And that's really how we're building Verset to adapt.
I mean, with this in mind, I think Verset is around 30 employees or a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yep, just a bit more. Yep.
With that trend, would you have done things differently? I mean, we spoke earlier in Launch and Learn with one individual who literally was, you know, it was a two people team, a company that was just would, you know, hire people as depending on the project. Would that be something mm-hmm. that you would maybe would do if you had to start from scratch again, or how do you see this?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there's actually a place for that, and I think that type of organization will probably do well in certain types of projects. I think there are just needs for scale, and I think Verset will scale its headcount as well. We've kind of kept at this size. It's enabled us to do large projects and to, you know, be able to prove out the model. But I think there are also there is a need for scale at a certain point, and you know, or certain types of organizations just require larger teams to support them. The other sort of view, and this is kind of important to our model, is that as a platform, any decision we make has to be in service of making the platform stronger. And so some of those decisions are around how do we ensure that, you know, a lot of that creative and insight and research skill sets, how do those get retained within Verset so we can help apply it to our future clients? And so if all of that sort of walks out the door every day on every project, I think you lose part of that magic. And so, you know, our view would be that there's a balance point. I don't think it's a strict thing for each company. It's probably different for everybody, but for us, I think we still want to be able to to retain that type of knowledge and to apply it to our clients as part of sort of our core value that we'll offer.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's been 8 years since you guys started. How has your kind of your offering or your approach changed? I mean, probably a few times since you started, but what are some of the things you've changed, maybe your methodology or your approach since you started?
Yeah, I think, well, like every company, you kind of learn as you go. I think, and I still think we're like in chapter one of a long, long book. So we'll continue to evolve a lot of those thoughts. But yeah, I think we had really said, well, what is sort of the driving force decision point that leaders are assessing when thinking about their future state? And the answer that came to us was they want to build and design products that are high in utility, but that look and feel great. You know, one of the broader mega insights that's not unique to us, but I think is broadly observed, is that customer expectations are extraordinarily high. You know, if as a consumer, you get treated to just remarkably elegant and fast and speedy and performant digital services every day. And that expectation has really forced a lot of companies to think differently about how their own experiences look and interact. And so when we started the company, we said, okay, well, let's think about design first. There's a lot of ugly things out there that aren't working, customers hate. You know, how can we help solve that problem? And so that was really how we oriented the company, was around, you know, helping businesses design really nice and beautiful things. The natural outcome of that, though, which we quickly learned, was that that is not the whole equation, because you need to be able to build and create those things. And oftentimes, the value is destroyed when there's not a close tie between design and development. And the other part was that you can design and build extremely elegant things, but that doesn't mean they're going to be used, and it doesn't mean that they're going to drive any value. And we've learned that, you know, I think over the years, and as that evolution became more clear, it became really obvious that if we were being hired to design beautiful things, then we were going to be failing more often than not, because the design of something had very little correlation to business impact or organizational impact or community impact. We needed to be involved in the sort of mission setting of that organization and really understanding, you know, what the objectives were, so that the outcome would be, you know, more aligned with what the organization is trying to do. And so we kind of used the analogy of like moving up the stack, but, you know, the strategy part of our business, which is our biggest part of our business now, was really a response to saying, let's ensure that the things that are important, like design and development and elegant and creating great customer-centric experiences, that matters, but we have to make sure that we're doing the right things. And it's like, you can pick at low-hanging fruit across a customer journey map, but you have to make sure you're looking under the right tree. And sometimes that's not as clear as it might be at the outset. And so we've oriented our whole company around, you know, helping our customers choose us because they want that level of insight. And that's been a broader shift. You know, we didn't start that way. It's been really a response to the client need.
Well, what you mentioned, I mean, totally. I mean, customer expectations is very high now with digital products. What is your timeline when it comes to development and design? I mean, are you doing, let's say, minimum viable products, something scrappy in 2 weeks, or what is sort of, where do, are you sort of this in this this range, I guess?
Yeah. So, we have a bit of a, I think MVP is one of those terms that should just be tossed because it means so many different things to so many people. It's almost like impossible to define. So we try to avoid that, but I think we would be quick to prototype and we'd be quick to test and to start sort of understanding if what our research is telling us and what we intuit as important is sort of resonating with core demographics. And so I think where we see a lot of success has been through adapting our research practices to be more build and test oriented than just search and find. So, you know, how can we create and get tools into the hands of people early as a means of research to sort of enable a better design and development process post? So that sort of change, I think, has been really helpful for us. So an example would be like, if we know that there's a certain problem area that we're exploring that has something of interest that we want to tap into, we would try to like create tools and systems. And that could be a simply something no code, it could be an Excel spreadsheet, but some way of sort of capturing the information and observing what happens with it so that we can sort of create better tools immediately versus sort of trying to design something, you know, through, let's say, like a prototype and then asking people what they think about it. So that's been an evolution of our change over the last, you know, year or two. And I think we're trying to race to build things faster and test it in those environments. And then I think once you get to the actual, you know, solution to say, okay, we really know, I think we've got an inkling that this is the right direction. We would take the approach that having an opinionated view is important in product. So not just relying on, you know, what the data is telling you or what the market is bearing, but to say, you know, as a stance, this is what this company is going to put into the market. And sometimes that takes a little more time. You know, I think we've seen success in certain use cases where getting something to market quickly with a limited feature set makes sense. In other cases, it doesn't. You know, where you need to launch something that's more full featured, and that can take more time. So we try to remain open-minded to that, but to be really careful observers of the market. So in the insurance example I gave in the Caribbean, you know, we spent a pretty rapid time on the research front to enable that we, you know, could kind of gut check what digital insurance would mean regionally. But we knew generally what a digital insurance experience should and could be in its different iterations, both from a, you know, practical, can you get a claim and sign up for insurance and manage your insurance, all the way through to, you know, what does the future of insurance look like? You know, are there technological advancements that will enable a different type of insurance, like maybe insurance per mile, which you're seeing a lot in the US. So those types of that innovation arc is actually quite clear. And so the roadmap is more determined by ensuring that it's localized, that it's performant, that it works within the strategic advantages of the company, that it's enabled by the technology that's, you know, already there, and those types of questions. And so in that case, we spent quite a lot of time on the design and engineering of it to fine tune it to be as great as it could be before launching versus something else. But what we did do is we, you know, set a bunch of sort of fake landing pages out there with the brand name, just testing user demand. So are people interested in insurance in these regional areas? Yeah, let's put up a WordPress site and start collecting email addresses and see what works. So on the research side, absolutely. But on the product side, we'd be of the view that, you know, because customers have such a broad experience with quality, they're going to want to see quality in sort of first early iterations of products, or you might miss the boat.
And I guess you have to take in consideration like the industry and the location, right? How familiar they are with digital products. What's the standard for financial accessibility, things like this too?
Yeah, it's definitely a spectrum. Yeah.
How do you get that kind of boots on the ground, like perspective from people that are in a country maybe might have never been to yourself, you know?
Yeah, Yeah, so we try to go there, you know, whenever we can. I think there's a lot of value in creating experiences just by observation, a lot of empathy that can be developed there. So a good example of that is part of the go-to-market strategy was out-of-home media. And one of our ideas was like, oh, we should maybe consider like a billboard campaign. And the guy kind of laughed at us. He's like, well, there's one billboard in Barbados. So that's the campaign. so, you know, like, but that's something we wouldn't really know, right? Like you wouldn't naturally go to that conclusion. And so there's value in being on the ground, but there's also value in local partners. So, you know, in that case, we worked with on the ground product photography studio. We worked with on the ground researchers. So, you know, we want to be able to make sense of any environment that we're interacting with. And oftentimes that kind of means a blended approach. Certain markets are different for sure. You know, when you're like a good example would be in the Middle East. We've done projects in, throughout, you know, Dubai, et cetera. How products are interacted with and engaged with are just very different. And so, you know, you want to make sure that when you're designing something that it's in tune with that market and adds the correct level of clarity. Because as much as a lot of the world is becoming more and more globalized, there are still unique patterns and ways of thinking and acting in every different little region, whether that's a province in Canada or a state in the US or a country. There's still lots of different patterns there that can often lead to good insights if you're listening.
Looking back, I mean, now it's been 8 years. What are some things that, you know, along the way that you kind of wish that you knew from the beginning so you didn't make these mistakes?
That's probably like another hour long discussion. you know, I think there's quite a lot. You know, we've really learned how important client selection is and project selection is. And I think we could have benefited that lesson from day one. You know, there's this loop that gets created where it's like you select to take on a client. That project happens, your team either enjoys or doesn't enjoy working from it, either learns from it or doesn't learn, either, you know, is able to create value or doesn't create value. And then that then informs your casework and what you can point to as examples, which then informs a broader set to select. And that loop, getting that right, is probably the most important thing a service company can do. You know, like making emboldened decisions to not work with clients or to, you know, fire clients if you want to be more intense. You know, one of the things that we had sort of made some calls on early on was around not doing maintenance work. So, you know, we decided with the size of our team and sort of the delivery methodology that we had, it didn't make sense to sign, you know, maintenance contracts with our clients. It wasn't what we were skilled at, wasn't what we did. And so we had to problem solve for that. You know, it took us a while because our clients were like, well, no, we want you to continue. You did a great job. Like, now we need you, you know, ongoing on retainer for the next few years to kind of QC this through. And we had a conviction that said, no, like this should be internally driven. For you to get the most value to accrue through this work, you need to be internalizing these skill sets. So let's do that work first. And so out of that sort of enabled now our more focus on operationalizing work and how to hire and train and support teams in doing that. And so we've spent a lot of time thinking through what that means in each organizational context, but that was something that took us a while to learn. And, you know, I think we've definitely made every mistake in the book, you know, in terms of building and scaling an organization and continue to, you know, there's just a lot to learn. Services is a messy business because it's naturally lumpy. You know, you have periods of intensity, you have periods of less intensity, revenue. It's a very revenue driven business. And so there's a lot of complexity there. You know, I think from the outside in, and once you've ran a service company, which I know both of you are really closely intertwined with service-based businesses, it's a tough game in many ways. And so through that, you learn a lot, but it's also exceedingly interesting and exciting, and I think intellectually stimulating to kind of be able to dive in and really solve these interesting customer problems. So it's been a great journey, but yeah, there's been lots of moments where you kind of look back and say, huh, we'd do that differently.
Bit of a random question, because you mentioned the whole topic of messiness. I mean, do you have, or have you, through the ages now, have you created some mental models that you use? So you go there, you're like, okay, you know, I can use this approach to break down a problem or figure out certain assumptions.
Yeah. We're big believers in sort of heuristics and mental models. I think the ones that sort of come up the most and I think are most helpful are like Munger's idea around inversion. So, you know, avoiding failure is a lot easier than trying to find great success. So, you know, looking at a product and saying, what risks can we mitigate here to ensure that it works, versus trying to say, what are the things we can do that'll ensure this huge home run? So we do a lot of that sort of inversion thinking, and that's been really helpful. I think this idea around doing less but better is also inherent within our frameworks. So, you know, you could look at that and to say, you know, if customers are sort of choosing you based on their experiences that they're having, doing things really well, but maybe doing a little bit less on that chain is probably more important. The other one that we think a lot about is like weak links versus strong links. So this idea that, you know, if you look at like sports as an example, like basketball is a really strong link sport. So if you have the best player, it's a good chance that you have a good chance of winning the game. So like it's very strong link driven. But a lot of companies are weak link driven, where your worst experience is what will define your success. So you're not as strong as your strongest link. You're as weak as your weakest link. And I think that applies to a lot of business experiences as well, where people sort of have a choice cascade presented to them with different options. And the companies that sort of look at all of those links along the chain and raise the level of all of them, versus the one that just picks it and hammers on one really strong link, my bet would be on the overall weak link strategy. So that type of prioritization and looking at how that fits into your own business is something that we apply a lot. So, you know, retailers were a good example where, you know, J. Crew had a very strong link retail presence, but had a very, very weak links across the rest of their chain. Customer acquisition, social, how they met their customers, how they consulted online, and they got hammered. Versus like say a Lululemon, you know, they have a very strong presence across a lot of the different links in that chain, and I think because of that, they're able to kind of meet their customers where they are and really, you know, drive results. I mean, they have like some of the highest retail sales per square foot of any organization in the world. So that sort of framework going back and forth has been a really important one for us.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Thanks for sharing your insight. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I always like talking about this kind of stuff with you guys, so appreciate the invitation.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one and see you next time on Launch and Learn.